Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 58. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey, I'm Sam.
Hey, all, I'm Mike.
Hello, I'm Nick.
And I am your host tonight, Dylan. This episode is being recorded on September 19th, 2024. Today, we'll be discussing the film Pat Labor 2, and there will be extensive discussion, probably spoilery stuff in there, so you have been warned. Please join us. And with that, I say Hashin. So, Pat Labor 2 was released on August 7th, 1993. Was produced by Production IG with storyboards and by Mamoru Oshii, script by Kazunori Ito, character mecha designs by the rest of the headgears of Yutaka Izubuchi, and then along with for Mecha, a couple other people that you may have heard of Hajime Katoki and Shoji Kawamori.
Actually, I had a question about the character designs. I didn't have time to look into this, but the movie character designs are different from the anime ones, which usually Akemi Takada and, the other one, are credited with. So, who's responsible for that look?
I could have sworn I saw Akemi Takada in the credits, but that may have been for original character designs.
Very likely.
Yeah,
sure.
No, she is character designs, but
have at least one or two art books by her that have character designs much more like the movies, so I think she did have heavy involvement in them.
Yeah, she definitely was. There's also the significant involvement of Hiromasa Ogura as the art director and Kazuchika Kise as the animation director in there. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those, I think it's one of the things that is, you know, taking our immediate first aside, one of the most interesting things in this film, and I think also amongst Pat Labor overall, is that while it was really only produced from basically 87 to 93 here, with Pat Labor 2 being effectively the final entry in the original Pat Labor, there's each production has such different character and mecha design styles, and it makes them all feel very different and as though the character and mecha designs were, you can see the care that was put into it, in that in each of them they're an expression of something with the production and the intent of the of that production.
I will say the opening cut with I guess the post-war cut where you see Noah testing the new gear, or not gear, labor, like, optical system, that whole scene, the way everything was, you know, like cinematography wise angles, the mechanical kind of integration screamed Ghost in the Shell to me for some reason. It felt very very, very much that, especially, you know, Oshii being obviously, you know, heavily involved in both. The rest, I would say less so, but I do agree, though, the character designs, I don't know, this movie felt like, to me, almost that they were trying to do as close to a live-action kind of political thriller in the anime medium as they could. It's kind of my takeaway from it.
I think that's a reasonable one, and in reading a number of different blogs and other people's thoughts, I think that's a fairly reasonably consistent view of people's, and that's part of the design of the characters there, where you see so much of the softening and so much of the
more photorealistic style, right?
Yeah, but or just you could say like less anime style character design, like particularly in the eyes.
Kind of did that for movie one too.
They did. Definitely.
They did. Yeah, they definitely did. But this one took it. This one took it even further away from the great Masami Yuki style eyes and stuff for Noah, where they have such this very unique, interesting, almost hexagonal look to them. Mm-hmm. And here it comes down to there. The plot of the movie is, let's see here. The intro segment is effectively Southeast Asia, 1999. There is a UN intervention with Pat Labor's, where they are told that they are not allowed to engage while they're being shot at and attacked and get destroyed. Then we jump forward to February of 2002. We jump forward roughly 3 years, and we're set in February, which is also kind of interesting because Pat Labor movie one was set in August or whatever, in the middle of heat typhoon season where everything was hot, whereas this one was very, again, with this film, and I think with all the Pat Labor things, it comes down to clear intent and that everything is there for a reason. But it's set in February, which is this very cold month where things slow down and you're not boiling over, but things can still happen.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the film revolves around the initial instance, which is a missile striking a bridge, blocking out, and then a series of poor decisions by political and military leaders that evolves into a near coup and a standoff between police and military forces in Tokyo, leading to the SV2 members trying to take out the leader of this organization quite literally on their own.
With a little bit of help from...
what turns out to be can you call Arako a double agent? Like, that's kind of what he is?
You would call him a double agent. Yeah, because he is, I guess, he's an employee of the government, but he's also working for and working with Tsuge's school.
He was affiliated with Tsuge as, like, one of his, I guess you can call, disciples, but then they had a basically, what's the word I'm looking for?
A falling out,
yeah, over a significant philosophical disagreement on how to approach the, you know, how to move forward. Tsuge wanted to choose almost literally the nuclear option, whereas I think Arako wanted to take the more less heavy-handed approach, for lack of a better term, because I think he was fine with the information blackout, which was a real interesting, almost like predictive kind of interpretation of what the future, because this movie was made in 93 or released in 93, set in 2002, and goes to show like how significant, you know, like radio communication still was and still is to this day. Like, you know, there's a reason why so many redundancies have been in place. Because communications break down, then that's, you know, theoretically what happened in the movie could actually happen in real life.
Yeah, I mean, it's plausible that fully loaded attack helicopters could do that kind of damage if they had their absolute way in an undefended city and knew, had good target info.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of kind of production and things there, really, production did not start in this movie until July of 92.
Wow.
That's when Ishikawa said, okay, you guys are green lit. Like, go. And the movie came out like barely a year later.
I can believe that only because there are not too many cuts with what I would call absurdly good animation. Like, obviously the art quality is immaculate for the entire film, but there was only a handful of cuts that had, I would say, a lot of really painstaking, like, animation put into it versus the first movie, where I felt like the first movie had a lot more action in it.
Also, not a huge surprise, just because it can be faster to spin up a movie from an existing series, because a lot of the pre-pro work is done.
Yeah, and I'm also not clear to me there, like, how much of the script and or storyboards had already been figured out by that time, too.
I mean, I forget how long Miyazaki had to do The Castle of Cagliostro, but it was, like, on the order of months, I think.
Oh my gosh.
Really? Jeez.
The other thing of this that is a huge thing, if you haven't seen it, you haven't seen a while, is that this is also a reworked, definitely, an expanded and different version, but it's taken from the original, or now called what, Early Days OVAs episodes, volumes 5 and 6, SV2's Longest Day. Which has a very, it's the overall kind of big picture plot is like nearly the same.
Really? Yeah, I was thinking about that when I was watching, because when I haven't seen both in a while, I tend to kind of conflate aspects of the two, not being sure which was which.
Right. Yeah, it's very similar. I didn't rewatch that OVA segment there, but I was looking at some of the book stuff and they're like, oh yeah, they were very popular OVA segments or episodes, and people are kind of like, hey, could you guys make that into a movie? And they're like, all right, well, let's take this. So that's another one of those things of, yeah, existing stuff, and they kind of already had an idea, and I think they'd probably already worked a bunch of the script and storyboard stuff a little bit ahead of time, but it's still pretty crazy.
Interesting. Wikipedia claims that was the original plan, was to just reuse the OVA plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had to rework it a bit because the world had changed a bit in the meantime.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, because I think just between Pat LaBorre movie 1 and Pat LaBorre movie 2. Pat LaBorre movie 1 was released in I think it was July of 89, and then movie 2, which came out in August of 93. So in that time period, you had one peaking and then crash of the Japanese bubble. That happened in roughly early 92. Berlin Wall fell in November of 89. Mm-hmm. Tiananmen Square, that was just before Pat LaBorre won.
88, I believe.
It was June of 89.
Oh, was it 89? Okay.
Yeah, so it was literally happened like a month before Pat LaBorre movie 1 was released. We have the fall of the Soviet Union in December, at end of December of 91. And you have the first Gulf War, which started in August of 90 and went through like February of 91. So that's a lot of things, especially for Oshii, who also has said in pretty much everything, and he's been hugely influenced by his being an activist in the 60s and his personal philosophical points. Mm-hmm. So that's just so much, so many big events.
I had no idea. I never, like, I knew all those things were going on, and if I think of, I only ever think of them individually, but altogether, that's a lot of stuff crammed in a very short period of time.
Yeah, this
movie in a 10-year window
really could have only been made between about late 1992 and, say, early 1996, because obviously this movie would not have been released after Om Shinrikyo. Like, the ending plot, at least not without the ending plot being reworked quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. With all the gas. Yeah.
Great point, Mike. Yeah, absolutely.
That was after, but yeah, that's a fair point there. So there's there's a lot of things that happen in there, and Oshii's a very aware person and lets these things, I think, influence the work that happens here. I think I want to... does anyone want to talk further on that area?
Not specifically the world events, no.
All right, so let's go into some of, I'll call it kind of the philosophy or kind of the thematic areas of the movie. There's I think a good number of main themes, which is one of the reasons why it's been such a well regarded movie that people have written about for decades and keep coming back to and writing more and thinking about it. But there is the big speech of the kind of the big speech of the movie is the idea of the unjust peace versus the just war. And what's the point of police and all of these things? And that comes out in this whole movie. A lot of it ends up being very dialogue and almost monologue-y periods with lots of peak background animation. Many people put in so much background work in this movie. So on that, I think Oshii's influences, another thing that happened in that time period was also when the JSDF had their first overseas deployments, where they did some work in support of Gulf War, and then they had, I believe, another peacekeeping mission that they were part of. So it was the first time since World War II that Japanese military forces were outside of the...
Or mobilized,
the
right?
main islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were deployed to Cambodia, which apparently Oshii and Ito were opposed to, according to Wikipedia.
Well, not a surprise then that the movie opens with the Mecca in Southeast Asia somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting... That's actually... It's such an interesting thing because this movie is so precise in everything, but it literally opens up with somewhere in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's such an interesting choice for a movie that's so precise in where everything is and how things get there and all of these bridges and everything and all of the pieces of, you know, Mecca and... how things are moving around. It's a
good choice, yeah. Because it allows, like, he obviously, I think they're referencing Cambodia and the whole incident, but I think being a little bit general about it allows people to kind of, I don't know, view it more as entertainment while he can still make a kind of political statement with
statement.
The movie.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. He wanted to not be super heavy handed. I think
politically the other way, but sort of like the Top Gun movies have never been really specific on the adversaries that Tom Cruise is going up against.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which is one of those things that's also made those movies, I think, able to be slightly more adapted. Now, that's not like a main thing in the movie that lets it work, but it's one of those small little pieces.
It grounds it.
Yeah. And I think this is also, having read some stuff, it's, you know, this is around the role that Japan has had in post-occupation world, where he's kind of like, well, and as the speech goes on, it's like, all right, well, what is this? We have this kind of this fake or this offshore piece where we get to feel good about things, but you know, what's the difference there? And Goto kind of has his counterpoint, which I take as being, okay, sure, but let's not go blowing up everything.
Yeah, right, and
that's not going to fix it.
The statement isn't untrue either. Like, the Japanese economy post-World War II was absolute crap, and we gave it some huge infusions with using it as a base during both the Korean and Vietnam Wars.
Yep. And that was one of the things that I've listened to a number of podcasts and stuff, but actually it was the anti-communist stuff that actually led the U.S. to stop the war crimes prosecutions in Japan, because they wanted a lot of the people that were going to be prosecuted to be their collaborators in the government.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting.
And the various continuations of the Japan-U.S., I forget the official name for the contract, but the security agreement, which led to many, many protests from all sorts of sides. Particularly, there was some particularly violent ones in the 60s, and certainly some of that activism is the stuff that Oshii was involved in.
Yeah, I need to really read more about Japanese activism in the 60s, 70s, because it seems fascinating just from the pieces of it that I've seen in movies.
Right. Very influential in, like, even in anime, right? Because isn't Akira kind of mm-hmm. based on some of that?
Jinro.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Ultimo was certainly influenced by all that stuff. He was probably another person who was act involved. Just as an aside, I've gotten a little behind in listening in my podcast, but I will definitely recommend the History of Japan podcast. The host, he teaches some stuff, has a PhD basically in Meiji era stuff in Japan, and does lots of episodes on various things, and has a whole bunch of different episodes on lots of interesting stuff in post-war Japan, politics, students, all the sorts of things. It's an excellent podcast. I could easily recommend, and I think he's got a pretty good website where you can probably find specific topics of things like that if you're interested. So there's an aside.
That's cool.
Thank you.
Another one that I want to go into, kind of keeping with the beginning of the movie, is this idea that is never said, because show don't tell, is the idea and kind of this theme of growth and letting go. Because this was supposed to be, and it was made to be, the final Pat LaBelle movie.
Well, really? Timeline-wise, it technically is. Still.
And it was also meant as a production. Like we're not going to consider, like, Wasted 13 wasn't a thing. The manga was still running. But that was kind of, you know, mangas like that have often been their own separate kind of world.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, basically, when the movie starts, you know, after the Southeast Asia, SV2 is already broken up from the crew that we knew.
Yeah,
it's already
kind of
over.
Feels like the early Star Trek: The Original Series movies in that respect. Like, the different people have moved on to new positions, and then an excuse comes to bring them back together.
I guess that's true. I haven't been that familiar, but that is definitely what happened there. And but I think it's interesting that, yeah, everyone's just like, yeah, you know, we're kind of, you know, it's a police or military organization where, yeah, everyone hopefully moves on and gets promoted and goes somewhere else after, you know, a couple of years, and goes to do something else. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing. It just starts out with that. And then nearly immediately you go to Noah, where you're like, oh, great, Pat LaBelle, Noah, Alphonse. And she walks up to, you know, Asuma has her walk up basically to a now kind of torn apart Alphonse. And she's like, it doesn't really mean anything to me anymore. I'm trying to be more than just that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think what movie 2 does well is that you really feel the progression of time between, like, movie 1, end of movie 1 and beginning of movie 2. Like, time didn't pause. These characters' lives went on, and, you know, they grew, like, they mature and grew. Like, Noah especially, I think, she was very, I mean, what little screen time she had anyway, she was very, I would say, calculated and more strategic in her mm-hmm. in her thinking. I think that's just her, you know, growth as a labor pilot. I mean, I think the only character that probably saw little to no growth was Ota, and that's more because he's like comic relief.
Yeah.
In many ways. So
actually, I suppose
having him as an instructor and, you know, kind of showing that the guts and the, you know, the fiery spirit can definitely, you know, carry you through it. But I mean, there's definitely like a time and a place, right? Like, he's still just like every other, you know, conflict you see with SV2, like nearly like gets everybody killed in the final infiltration mission because
they thought they had promoted him to a place where he could do, you know, next to no damage.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say Hiromi is the one who would change the least.
I mean, you're not wrong there. I think Hiromi was very comfortable with who he was at like when we met him and he first appears. He was very comfortable in Zoskin. He knew he was already content with his position within life and within SV2.
Yeah, I think that the stuff about moving on too is interesting in that it now that you mentioned, I'm thinking about it, and it does kind of permeate a lot of the movie. Shinobu kind of moving on Nagumo from Tsuge's, her relationship with him. And then even Goto, like him and Nagumo have this kind of, I don't know, weird unspoken relationship. But then even at the end of the movie, he kind of lets that go too when he sees her with Tsuge. He's like, oh, I guess I only have you guys, you know, looking at the SV2 team. That was kind of
I do like that the movie gives Nagumo more to do.
Yeah. For sure.
So I have opinions about how Shinobu was portrayed in the movie.
Go with it.
So she is, if not my favorite, like one of my two favorite characters, her and Goto, like trade spots. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they're mm-hmm. both very complex, very competent individuals that are, you know, always working to do the right thing by different means. Goto tends to use more illicit methods, and Shinobu tends to try to do it more, you know, through the right channels, and they both have had equal efficacy up until that point. And I was still very happy with both of them. I like that the movie largely focused on the two of them as mm-hmm. characters. What I struggle to accept is that one of the messages being portrayed was she was having difficulty kind of keeping her focus on the case because of this previous relationship we had with Tsuge, and I think that cheapens her character a little bit. I didn't really care for that element of it very much.
I do think they could have made her a little stronger while still keeping that.
Yeah, I think that's my main issues. I understand what the intent was, and I do think they did it okay. I think it's just more of a, I didn't care for it as much because I have a strong, you know, attachment to the character. I still think the execution was pretty good, but yeah,
I can see where there are a few moments of it that would rub you the wrong way,
especially the very very end where it was almost like she got to have her cake and eat it too because she apprehended him, and then they had that moment where they clasp hands. Like that really I disliked a lot, intensely disliked that specific scene. Yeah. I feel like she still didn't have to make the hard decision. You know, he let himself be apprehended because, you know, he still clearly has, you know, some feelings for her, and she obviously has them for him still. I think the way they have it end like that was a little bit, it cheapened it for me.
I kind of agree. It feels like a little bit, although, you know, I kind of enjoyed the play between characters, but with her and Goto and kind of what it forced there. But I do agree that it felt a little unnecessary, like to do that. I think it would have been much more interesting if she, I don't know, made it clear in another way and was a little bit harder in the end. You know, I don't know. It felt weak, I guess.
Yeah, for lack of a better term, it did feel weak to me, too.
It does give a plausible reason for her to actually be in, you know, exiled to SV2, though.
Oh, I mean, sure. I'm okay with the relationship. Right. I just didn't like how they ended it.
You know? I agree they could have ended it a little more, but it, you know, it, one does always kind of wonder how she got stuck with this. Goto, one definitely has more of a sense.
Yeah.
And I think I believe they do say that in the movie that, yeah, this was the one blemish on her record, and it kind of got her sent out to the Isle of Misfit Robots.
Yeah.
I mean, the way the police organization is portrayed in the movie, the higher-ups, it certainly, I could see them doing that.
Yeah, and then it also seems as though they realized that she was way too throughout everything, really, she's way too competent to let her be somewhere where she could actually, you know, not play ball with everyone according to the rules they're supposed to play by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, her and Goto both kind of don't like to fully play following the rules, just in different ways.
Yeah, on the end there, I mean, gosh, that animation with their hands is... it's insane, because look at it and you're just like, that's exactly like you see everything. You're like, I don't know who did that, animated that segment, but that is
the execution of it. Like Mike and I talked about earlier, like with all the, I totally forgot that like there was excessive use of birds in the movie too, as well, to a great effect. Like, I don't know if Oshii was going through like an Alfred Hitchcock birds kind of kick while making these two movies, but you know, I thought the use of the seagulls was fine, and that whole final segment was fantastically animated. Just the I just felt like it was such a weak ending. That was really my thing, was there's all this build up and they basically threw away their careers at this one chance to, you know, apprehend the mastermind behind all this, and it left a pretty bad taste in my mouth. Is I guess the best I can say.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because timeline wise, this is basically the end of Pat Labor. So I don't know. To have it end that way for me was a little bit weak, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have trouble seeing them going out any other way, though.
I don't mean the decision to apprehend Tsugi. I 100% but it's the interaction with Shinobu and Tsugi at the end. I really, really intensely didn't like. That was really kind of what almost ruins it for me. Not quite, but I really didn't care for it.
I can see that. I can also see it in that she's someone who is so guarded and so cautious and calculated in everything in her life, and this was the one, this fling that she had was kind of the one time where she was not as cautious. And it's not like she let him walk away or anything. Like, she came up and she's like, nope, you're arrested. And then there's this and the human level of it came through there, we're still figuring that out. It's not like she didn't handcuff him. She just did it to herself and was like, okay, I'm doing this for now.
See, what I interpreted is when she handcuffed him and then put the other handcuff on her was her basically saying that she is now and forever connected with him. And she was almost resigned to it. Like, that's the message that I really didn't like, was, like, she felt like she had to be, you know, forever affiliated with him, even though she apprehended him and stopped him. Like, this is still going to linger over her. I think that messaging I really didn't like.
Yeah, the cuffing the hand herself to him was pushed it really over the edge for me, too.
And, again, I'm being hyper-analytical and critical only because, Pat Labor is a property that I hold in such high regard. Like, it's probably in my top three of all anime, you know, properties as far as where I keep it in my own personal rankings. And again, and then within that, you know, Shinobu is I just hate to see characters I have a strong attachment to behaving unlike themselves for is I guess, I mean, it's not like they have to always act a certain way. Obviously, I'm not trying to project how I feel she should be. Like, yeah, she's always a strong, you know, female presence. She's always very decisive and, you know, very methodical. But it's not, I'm not suggesting she's not allowed to have moments of weakness, because that's really what this whole movie was exposing her one glaring, gaping, like, wound, emotional wound that she has in her life. And it's coming, basically coming out, her dirty laundry is being aired for everybody to see. Like, she's being completely humiliated this whole movie, more or less.
I just especially hate it because of the way that it just seems intentionally there to poke at Goto's character. Like, which, again, like I said, I kind of enjoy the dynamic. It's kind of bittersweet, and I see what they're going for, and I respect it, but, you know, I don't know. I feel like they could have played that a little different, but it's okay. So, like, we're being ultra critical, like Nick says, because we love this
movie so much.
Yeah, and
we're also reading a whole lot into handcuffing one person's arm to the other person, which is what anime cops usually seem to do, even if I don't think real life cops do.
Is that right? Am I just not? I don't recall,
like,
handcuffing.
Zenigata pretty much always tries to capture Lupin.
That's
that
true.
Way,
right?
Yeah,
that
wrong.
Is a fair point. Let's continue on this discussion of things that happen at the end and or after the movie, because I think that's the thing that in watching this time, and honestly, this movie, for whatever reason, is probably the Pat LaBeouf thing that I may have seen the least.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen the back half of TV and New Files less often than this. I think I've only seen those once, but
And I'm not saying, I'm just saying, like, for me, I might have actually have seen this the least, because it's such a weird, interesting thing, and I think I always took it as this, but seeing it this way with having watched, you know, more and re-Pat LaBeouring since the last time I watched this, it felt like it's such a sad end of, like, there's no real conclusion. Like, and also, like, it's, it does the same thing with the soundtrack, where it almost just kind of fades and just kind of stops and keeps thumping along as the soundtrack does the whole time. But it's not like, you know, if that movie were done by a different studio, they would have had, like, a whole, like, epilogue thing in the credits showing, like, people, like, doing stuff after the, like, mid-credit segments where people are, Hiromi's
out there.
I can't
imagine what other studio you're talking about.
Or, like, Hiromi's out there gathering up the chickens again, and Mikiyasu's back with his two kids, and Oji's back
out with his wife.
Yeah, reconciling with his wife again. It's that thing where you get none of that resolution. You don't even know, you think that Goto and Agumo's careers are over, kind of, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, are they?
I guess one of us will have to actually watch the live action Pat LaBeouf and maybe find out.
And then
not canon.
Yeah, well,
but apparently some eps of it are sequels to this movie.
That definitely gets a double, huh?
One thing, I'm actually okay with the ambiguity at the end, because I don't necessarily expect them to get a happy or not happy ending. I mean, I'm sure there's something in between that it could entirely have developed into. But my one big question is, how will the apprehension of Tsuge be perceived by the Japanese government? Because he was only really being targeted by Arakawa, who turned out to basically be kind of a double agent himself. So, like, basically, you know, to put it into super layman's terms, you know, you caught a bad guy, then another bad guy was telling you to grab. So it's like, how is that going to be perceived at the
end
of
the
day?
It's going to depend a lot on how the Japanese government ends up framing it.
Exactly, right? So, like, there's a lot of, like gap filling that needs to happen from the audience, which I don't necessarily mind. I think actually that makes it more interesting to talk about in forums like this. So,
in some ways I like things that leave an ending, particularly to something like this, with a good amount of ambiguity where you can go and write your own fanfic in your head and mm-hmm. come up with your own postscript to it. So I think that's fine.
Yeah, I agree with that, but also it is nice to get a little fan service epilogue kind of thing like Nick was talking about.
I would be, I would have, don't get me wrong, I would have loved one. I'm a sucker for epilogues, but you know, I'm also, especially at the point, I was talking about this with Michael earlier, like, my analysis of the movie now versus my analysis when I watched it when I was in my 20s is, like, completely different.
Oh, yeah.
Because the kind of things I value, both emotionally and politically, even, have changed mm-hmm. dramatically. So, also, just, you know, I think I can, my attention span is a little better now versus my my college years. So
I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't get into it as much was it felt kind of like, oh, well, this is kind of like Ghost in the Shell, except it doesn't have as many cool fight scenes as Ghost in the Shell movie. So this is weird.
Yeah, this was my favorite movie when I was young. I remember bringing this movie over to a friend's house on VHS to watch in high school, and my friend fell asleep in the middle of the movie, so I was left trying to figure out how to turn off all of his equipment so I could go to sleep.
That's interesting. So you were into Pat LaBour and two back in high school.
Yeah, I loved the politics angle. I don't know, for some reason.
Yep.
Although it's watching it now, I really had no comprehension of what was going on. When I watched it back then, I understood made a lot more sense to me this time, although I think I still didn't get 100% of it.
Well, and there's also the differing perspective of everything. And I think it's one of the things that keeps the movie being interesting is that, like, you could see it in the earlier mid 90s and be like, oh, this is kind of a weird thing. That would be weird to have that happen. And then you see it after 9/11 or after Al Shinkryo, and you're like, okay, so that happened.
And then you see it after, say, some of the things that have been happening in this country in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you have this, yeah, this more, you know, battles and thickness, varying thickness levels of varying colored lines, and this feeling of this more threat of this thing, which is another one of the, I think, the huge underlying things of this movie is occupation. And I think it's probably I think it's the most interesting segment in the whole film is the stuff where you have the military going through the town, but it's basically just these montages of what these days would just be iPhone videos of people where there's a bunch of tanks and stuff, but everyone's just like, whatever, mm-hmm. going to work, taking selfies with them.
In some ways it reminds me of kind of, you know, the civilian footage from Ukraine where everyone's just going on with their lives until an alert happens.
Yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. I think I shared on the Discord someone had done a video edit to the same, not the same cuts, but the same soundtrack that played in the background of soldiers and stuff doing a thing in Stockholm. And I'm not sure exactly, like, and Stockholm was not an occupied city, but there was some sort of military stuff there. But it was very interesting to see that exact thing proceeding out and how people are willing to adapt to any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, the one story element that I totally don't buy into and movie two is the main, I would say, motivating factor as to why they had felt like they had to act sooner was the whole information that the U.S. was going to launch, you know, was mobilizing, you know, or was already headed across the Pacific into, you know, Japanese waters. I'm like, I really don't see the U.S. government, like, putting much effort into a situation like this. if it happened. Like,
certainly not in our world, though the U.S. government in Pat Libber's world has already done some dubious.
I mean, you could make the argument that it's like agreement, like because Japan technically has no military, they have the SDF, and if it looks like the SDF can't be relied upon, then it's possible that like they're like, well, it's kind of our responsibility, so we have to do something.
Yeah, I get like the purpose for it, but that was the one area where I was kind of like, okay, now I'm starting. Obviously, outside of the whole like one person can actually like basically destabilize the, you know, military and law enforcement of an entire established nation. Like I felt like that was pretty ambitious, but you know, it's a movie, so
Though certainly the you know, they set up that very elaborate scenario to get the helicopters into Tokyo, but as 9/11 showed, like, most places don't really, like, post-Cold War didn't have the air defenses to do much anyway. So, like, the interceptions were actually pretty fast of the ghost blips compared to reality.
Right, wasn't that comment they made in the movie about the defecting MiG that came over and they, like, they had no idea what to do about it?
I remember I did listen to a thing on that, and I forget the details of that.
I mean, I would say that it's implausible for the U.S. to do nothing with as much military as we have in Japan to a military situation arising in Japan. I feel like we would be doing something, I just don't know exactly what.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. Like, I guess for me it was the more like, really, they're gonna mobilize, like, across Pacific when they have Okinawa occupied already. Yeah. They could have just sent some support, air support through Okinawa, and that would probably have been far more than sufficient.
Or Yokosuka, which is right there.
So. Yeah, exactly. And Yokosuka, exactly.
Like, at the same time, though, I think that is, like you said, some of that is the movie and some of it is the philosophical thing of being, all right, well, what if, you know, what if you had someone in charge of the U.S. who decided to make a crazy decision to be like, no, actually, we're rolling in.
I certainly admit that feels more plausible than it did at the time.
You could argue that, like, the sending of the ship across the Pacific was kind of putting things in place for in case their larger action was required. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Like, that's what the U.S. military does. Like, that part seems completely reasonable, where they would say, okay, we know what's going on here. Let's get ourselves so we're close enough that we can act immediately whenever we decide we need to take action. Now,
yeah,
it could be
the U.S. would not put the Japanese government back into place at the time if it still existed feels dubious.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the idea was, I read it as not them being worried about not putting the government back, but losing face, right? Like, if the Americans take care of a problem and on Japanese soil, it looks really bad for them that they can't take care of themselves.
True.
And that sort of thing has come from other things, like I was just thinking of that again. I was reminded of Shin Godzilla.
Yeah, watching this reminded me of Shin Godzilla quite a bit, actually.
Ditto.
There's it's a lot of political stuff with some vague and then very overt threats from the United States and others.
And you have attack helicopters in Tokyo.
No, explosive trains, though.
Oh, but there was secret trains did help
true.
In this.
True.
Huh?
Is that real?
Come on, man.
Do you guys know if the Shimbashi station, that abandoned station, is real?
Off of my knowledge from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I have to say yes.
I mean, weren't they saying that was that existed because of that's where the Babylon Project tunnels connect with stuff? So probably not real, right?
Since it had been inactive since 1940, whatever. So
yeah, so I would not be surprised. I don't know if that exact one exists, but I would not be surprised if there are some levels of these various unused train station terminal things. I mean, it's all over the place. It's in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It's in Ghostbusters. I mean, if this is not true fact, then I don't know what is, and my life has no meaning anymore if I can't rely on those two things.
I mean, there is a lot of buried infrastructure under big cities.
Right.
Yeah.
To that degree, I don't know, though Japan has some absolutely massive underground flood control projects that I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, they need it because they're in the middle of Typhoon Alley, so. Mm-hmm.
So I can certainly believe Japan would do something on that scale.
I mean, I've heard of it in other places. I'm pretty sure London has a bunch of those kinds of abandoned stations.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if New York has at least a few.
Yeah, and Japan went way deep for a lot of those things, too. So,
yeah, it's such an interesting, complete aside from this, of the subterranean secret history of cities.
Totally miss the train passing on a different track through Shinjuku Station. That was like, yeah, good luck getting the right track, guys.
Yeah.
There was on one of our commentary things, there was some stuff that Mike, you'd said about Animago and Wizardry and with the jets.
That the call sign of the JSDF jets that were intercepting the blips or something was it the ones intercepting the blips or was it the ones firing at the
bridge? The blips were Wyvern, I think.
Yeah, Wyvern.
Yeah. Anyway, there were a couple of fighters call signed Wizard and Wizard 03 to Trebor. Trebor is Robert Woodhead of Animago's alias. Trebor is Robert spelled backwards that he used when he wrote in the Wizardry games.
Oh.
That makes sense. I was like, that's such a weird name.
Yeah, I was like, did they mean Trevor? Like,
Yeah, so that makes me wonder if someone stuck that in just as a fan of the Wizardry games, or if someone had interacted with Robert, because he had apparently been living in Japan from about 89 to 95 or so during the early days of Animago.
Judging on the people that were involved there, I would think it was probably a Wizardry fandom that they needed some Englishy sounding names, and Wizardry had that, so they put those in there.
Certainly could be, you know, just choosing code names from a video game is certainly something that we would never do, right?
Right. Definitely not.
But, though it also could have been someone interacting with him. I can't remember when, I know Animago did the subs on Beautiful Dreamer. I don't know when they got that license. Or rather, when CPM got that license, because CPM got the Beautiful Dreamer license and Animago got all the other movies and everything else.
So it's certainly
possible that there had been some, because of Urusei Yatsura, interaction or
awareness,
I don't know, maybe
or
something else. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. So we're coming up on the end of time here, so I'll give folks a little bit of time to have some kind of fun stuff. We can do our own fun epilogue at this episode here. We don't have to end on a fade to black. So I'll let people say, what's your favorite background? This could be a image, something, mecha, person, segment, whatever, something that was kind of a background thing that was going on. I can start off because it was one of the scenes with Matsui where, one of the Matsui scenes. He's so great. But in the background, he's in the office of the video production company, and they have these posters in the background. I'll put it in our thing there. Say Vogel on it, and it's birds again across three different posters. And it's just one of those things where I'm like, man, it's such cool. I don't know if it was, I assume it was made up and wasn't like a copy of something that was real, but you look at it and you're just like, this is like just grade A production design stuff.
If you look in the backgrounds and at other times, right, they have, anytime there's screens that's playing birds flying across the screen. So it was I think that's just a Oshiism.
So that's mine. I'll call on someone unless someone wants to speak up.
I'll give mine since you said Matsui. My favorite one is, I won't say strictly a background thing, but just this one cut where Matsui's talking to Goto after he just escaped that the blimp thing, and he's like, I laughed out loud when this scene came up. I had completely forgotten about it or just didn't appreciate it, where he's sitting there on the phone with this pipe under his arm that he's handcuffed to, and he's talking on a cell phone next to a sports car with the window smashed and a gangster sitting on top smoking a cigarette looking very unhappy. And it's just like, it tells a story there in that just like those few seconds, and it's so good. It's hilarious. It's so thoughtful. Really, really well done.
That's a great cut. I kind of liked the POV cut with the three of them all trying to squish into the screen.
Oh yeah, that was my other favorite one that I love. The writing in that one too was just so good. The back and forth about like, oh okay, it comes up. Oh, this is just the song. Do you want to sing it? Oh, we don't have a mic. Oh,
and
yeah. Well,
did you notice also that it was, you know, kind of done the style of like a karaoke like video, and has the name of the song, and then the composer, and it's Kenji Kawai.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that.
Kenji Kawai didn't catch that, but I'm not surprised.
He's credited as the composer there. I'm like, I wouldn't be surprised if he actually did compose that song specifically for the movie.
So the interesting thing there is now Kenji Kawai is a canon person that exists within the Palabore universe.
Immortalized.
Which I was like, oh my gosh, Kenji Kawai is actually part of Palabore universe now. Oh man, it's so wild.
That's so good.
All right, who else has a thing?
I guess I'll go. Thanks, Sam. You actually took the exact one I was going to say, and I was actually kind of... I had several, so thanks for covering that one. Mine isn't so much a background thing, it's more of a little detail thing, specifically for Arakawa, but his lazy eye.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The detail, even on very distant cuts, where you can still see that something is off about him, because he has, and I'm assuming that's an injury from the war, because it was heavily inferred he served with Tsuge to some degree, so he probably was, you know, had some sort of injury in combat. But
just I'm trying to remember back to the picture of the Tsuge school, if he's in that picture, and if so, does he have the lazy eye there?
I didn't notice, because obviously your eye immediately goes to Tsuge and Shinobu, like, front and center.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I think Arakawa also, just as a character, was, like, such a cool addition. Like, a one-off addition. Like, he fits into the Pat Labor world so perfectly, and he played off of Goto so well. Like, they were both, you know, like, playing, you know, 5D chess in each other's heads the entire time, until Goto finally checkmated him at the very, very end. Mm-hmm. Which was, like, so satisfying, right? You're like, this guy is a scumbag, and he's bad, but how are we gonna get him? And then you go to just literally, you know, keikakudori'd him, like, at the very end, like, literally. Like, it was the perfect, you know, checkmate scenario. So, just, yeah, I think just for me, all this cuts with Arakawa and his lazy eye.
I want to say, in that vein, that I did want to mention that watching it this time, you know, like, my Japanese is better than when I was in high school. So like, I actually didn't notice his lazy eye, the first times that I watched. This is the first time I actually noticed the lazy eye. I thought that was interesting, and yeah, what it did for his character.
And you think you noticed it this time because you were not as concentrated on reading the subtitles, and you're able to more kind of do our professional subtitle reading technique.
Yeah, right, of the glance and absorb, because this movie is so dense that, like, when I was younger, I had to have my face locked on the bottom of the screen the whole time.
Plus VHS quality.
Yeah, that's true. Although I was watching on my Onyami's DVD, so...
Okay.
Not super great either, but better than VHS.
Yes. All right. Mike, do you have... something to be You didn't say well, something,
I did you? Said the monitor perspective scene, but another one I liked is the dog when the helicopters are taking off as they're aft from their crates.
The Basset Hound, the obligatory. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that the first time we really see Oshi dog? Like as prevalently? Because I don't remember seeing Oshi dog like that in like Pat LaBour movie 1 or other stuff. I don't know if it shows up in any of the Urusei Yatsura stuff.
Is this the only time he's put it in a movie?
No. It shows up in like everything after this.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember if there were any dogs in Beautiful Dreamer. I don't feel like it, but who knows?
There's so many weird scenes in in that movie.
And I just rewatched that earlier this summer, but
how could you not remember every cut? Come on.
Yeah, actually, I do expect Mike to memorize that movie inside out.
Okay. Does anyone have anything else, any other comments or anything you wanted to say that I cut you off on?
No, I think I got out all my favorite stuff, so.
Yeah, right. I think I got out everything I needed to.
So everyone is entitled to having so many more different thoughts and philosophies and things and stuff you think is important and all the things that we didn't talk about. Like, we literally said the word Matsui once, which is a shame because he's wonderful. There's too much to cover on this.
He's lots of people one of my favorite background characters in the series. Like, he's always fun when he shows up.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, with that, I don't think we have any corrections, additions. We don't have an exact date as usual, but next time we'll be covering, I forget the exact name, but I'll call it Berserk
Golden Age TV series.
So it's the one that is up and streaming on Crunchyroll, which is not the Berserk 2016 series. It's the TV episode length version of the movies, which are now you can't get the movies, but you can get these. So you'll figure out which one it is. you'll figure it out.
Trust you.
So we're gonna, it's the whatever the, I think it's 12 or 13 episodes. So we're gonna discuss that one next time. We'll finally go into the we'll finally get our Behelites out and get our sacrifice on and go into the Berserk well. So with that, I say thanks for listening, and until next time, this is AMO Kenzoku saying Saraba.